Severin Films presents the complete Umberto Lenzi Carol Baker Giallo Collection Blu-ray box set that includes four Blu-rays of Orgasmo, So Sweet So Perverse, A Quiet Place to Kill, and Knife of Ice, Never Before on Disc in America, plus two CDs of soundtrack music from all four films, all starring Carol Baker and directed by Umberto Lenzi. Orgasmo contains both the unrated director's cut and the U.S. release X-rated cut under the title Paranoia. Each disc comes with an exclusive video interview with the late great Umberto Lenzi, plus audio commentaries from Italian genre film scholars. The complete Umberto Lenzi Carol Baker Giallo Collection, Orgasmo, So Sweet So Perverse, A Quiet Place to Kill, and Knives and Ice, 6-disc box set available for pre-order right now over at www.severin-films.com, and also available now on demand, the award-winning Severin Films production, Blood and Flesh, The Real Life and Ghastly Death of Al Adamson.
For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers around the world. Diabolik offers a one-stop shopping experience for all of your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabro, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Their latest arrivals include from Arrow Video, the complete Gamera collection and Beyond the Door, from Cauldron Films, Abracadabra and American Rickshaw, and from Scream Factory, Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. Whether you're looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you have been craving. Shop online at DiabolikDVD.com, and that's Diabolik with a K.
It's a little crazy out there right now, so Fangoria is offering a free 2-month digital membership to everyone. Go to Fangoria.com for more information to make an account. Then pore over all the exclusive articles, interviews, and reviews on the site, as well as original video content and podcasts. You'll even have access to high-resolution scans of the first 15 issues of the original run of Fangoria magazine and counting. Go to Fangoria.com now to start your free digital membership. And if you're looking to add to your social distancing watch list, Fangoria's latest movie, VFW, is now available to stream on demand, and Satanic Panic is streaming on Shudder now.
It's episode 188 of Shockwaves. I'm Rob Galuzzo, one of your hosts, in quarantine with, well, not with anybody, but I'm on Zoom and Zencaster with Ryan Turek.
Hey, what's up?
What's up, man? How are you?
I'm in quarantine. It's all good.
All right. Elric Kane, how are you? I'm already out to Elric.
We're all punchy tonight.
Elric Kane, how are you? Are you there?
I'm fucking beautiful.
You don't have air conditioning, so you're the only one that looks very much like Vice Squad Wings Hauser right now, sweaty and all.
It does. Hot as balls over here.
I was going to go Joe Zito, but yeah.
Joe Zito. And Rebecca McKendry.
Hey, guys. Still in quarantine. Doing okay.
Becca, I predict microphone troubles for you later in the show. I'm just calling it now.
Don't fucking do that. Stop.
We're all a little punchy tonight because we've just been, it's been endless technical issues.
Oh my God.
No fault, but you know, the show must go on.
The internet gods are just not shining on us tonight.
So let's
got a great show for you tonight.
Horror.
So horror.
Horror. Well, who do we have on later on? Rob? Who are our special guests?
We have the Fine Fiends from Vinegar Syndrome coming back on. They've been on, I think, twice before at this point. And people love them. I don't know if their fans love us, but I know that people love them. They're just going to kind of bring us up to speed on their halfway to Black Friday sale. Hopefully we'll get a title announcement out of them, and we'll get to talk a little bit about some of their recent releases like Candy Snatchers and so on. So should be a fun
spoiler
chat. Spoiler alert.
Love it. I know for a fact that it's a fun chat. I know for a fact.
All right.
And Becca will have issues.
I will have microphone issues. Well done.
Hurricane psychic.
I saw so much good stuff. Let me tell you some new stuff I saw. I saw all new stuff. This never happens to me. Let me start. Well, actually, the worst segue. Actually, let me start with the old thing. I saw a couple of our listeners backing up Becca's claims of how scary Marianne, the TV show, was. Mm-hmm. And Jesus fucking Christ. I watched all eight episodes between last week and this week. And
yeah, this is on Netflix, right?
Yeah, it's on Netflix. It's a French show, but I watched it in the dubbed, and then the American dubbed. And after one episode, I tried to go back to subtitles. And once you're used to a voice, you can't go backwards. So I don't know which is the better. The horror of this is as good as Flanagan's House on Haunted Hill. The horror elements are on that level. They are scary. They are well paced. They are weird. It's like my perfect kind of horror gags. The only thing I don't like about the show compared to Flanagan's is
it's not coming back. Drama.
Is it not coming back?
No. That's why I haven't committed to it, because I'm like, no, Marianne's not coming back, which is deeply
disappointing. It doesn't need it. It doesn't need it. It's a perfect one-season show. It ends with a cliffhanger that it's just like bonus.
I did mention that, Elric, technically you were not allowed to watch this yet, because I only recommended this to you in December. I mean, it's only been like 4 months. This just isn't how this works. But
thank listener Justin LaFleur for his little Facebook plug that pushed me over the edge. I never have time for TV, doing all these podcasts. I'm always watching movies, so this is a rare period, but I really like this. I can't say enough of how it nails the heart. What I was going to say about the drama is, and sometimes some of this is the dubbing and stuff, it's a little juvenile at times. So it's like it goes from this very serious, I would say, In the Mouth of Madness tone, which is the closest movie I could place on this series, because it's about a writer who has written this very famous series, and it's very scary. And when she goes back to her town, you realize she is more or less not entrapping that storyline in her books, but the two things are symbiotic. And so it has a lot of similarities to In the Mouth of Madness. You could definitely imagine an American version set in Maine, easily.
Yeah.
It's just got these kind of it'll go from like something really scary and serious to somebody making dick and sex jokes constantly, that after a while I was like, those aren't landing in the same way as the rest of the show's landing. So it wasn't enough to take me out. It was just, it's the one thing I would change about it. It knocks it down like a minor fraction, but honestly, it's in terms of horror, I put up there with like Terrified in terms of like the kind of some of the sight gags. Like they're really creepy. The witch stuff is creepy. The faces and it's really good. So definitely want to make sure, if you were like me and you just kind of wait on TV, this was definitely one of the best series I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, I did the dubbed version as well, because I watch this one on a treadmill for like a week straight. I watched one every day, and you can't read very well on a treadmill, or at least I can't. I fall. So I did the dubbed one with this, and I thought it was just as good. Like, I didn't even question it. It was a decent dubbing.
Yeah, no, it's really good. So jump into it if you can. I'll do one more of the other new ones. I saw three new films, but I'll throw on my favorite of the three was 1BR, which is One Bedroom. This played back at Beyond Fest. That's when it got on my radar, and I was hoping it would come out a long time ago. A very simple film, LA set film. I say it's Martyrs by Way of the Invitation on a Starry Eyes budget. And that is everything you'll ever need to know about that movie.
That sums it up nicely, Elric.
And it's all good. Trust me, all of those are good. The only issue I'd say is the invitation, the ending it has that gets strays very close to that film. It's a little too close, but getting there is really, it's pretty fun and interesting. It's basically a movie that would be, if I even give you past the setup, it's really just, it'll be spoiled for you, because like Martyrs, a lot of it is that kind of pacing. So, but it's about a girl who moves, trying to get a hard to get apartment in LA, as it always is. And this really kind of perfect community vibe to this apartment complex. She gets picked, she moves in, and then some bad things start to happen. And it's very much about assimilation and stuff. I think it's a really good little indie. I just wouldn't want to say any more than that. And it is on VOD right now.
Nice. Excellent. Cool.
How about Ryan or Becca?
I can hit you with the marathon I did. As families do, we sit down and we watch all the Hannibal movies together. So we watched. So we began in chronological order of Hannibal's journey. So we watched Hannibal Rising, Manhunter, Red Dragon, Silence of the Lambs, and then Hannibal. And you know what? Hannibal Rising does not ever need to be seen again. I've probably seen it three times in my lifetime. That is just, I mean, there's no, this isn't a knock against the movie. The movie is actually not, is pretty well made, but in terms of a prequel story to the Hannibal Lecter legacy, it is, you know, this is one where you have no one to blame but the creator himself, Thomas Harris. He wrote, you know, he created this. He wrote the book. I read the book. And it's just not the prequel story you want to have associated with the Hannibal. Because if none of you have seen it, basically Hannibal Lecter grew up orphaned, and then he becomes basically a Nazi hunter in his teen to 20s, 20-something years. And it all stems back to childhood trauma that he experienced when he was trapped with these desperate Nazis in an abandoned home during World War II. And so then we go on to Manhunter, which is a stroke of fucking cinematic genius. It deviates from the book, you know, in terms of the finale and other, you know, different variations. And Lecter, Hannibal Lecter, is actually spelled L-E-C-K-T-O-R in Manhunter. And that movie is just, I mean, like, again, this is a movie I've seen since I was a kid, and every time I watch it, it's just, I'm in awe of Michael Mann's visual, you know, narrative filmmaking. And also the last 15 minutes of that movie are incredibly memorable and amazing.
In Agata DeVita, baby.
Yeah. So good. And a great performance by Thomas, you know, Tom Noonan. And it's just a fantastic film. Now, segueing from that to Red Dragon, which is, again, like Hannibal Rising, is a lesser seen movie to me. You know, look, Red Dragon has a uphill battle. You know, it really does. It has an uphill battle, and it's a tough climb given that Manhunter exists. And granted that it came in the wake of Silence of the Lambs. I don't think it's a terrible film. It just lacks personality. It lacks an identity, and it's incredibly faithful to the book. From what I recall, I read the book when I was in high school, but in terms of being faithful to the Hannibal Lecter legacy, it's there. I mean, the finale's there, everything that they baked into the book is in there. I think everybody's very good. Ralph Fiennes is excellent.
He's really good.
Ralph Fiennes is very good. And, you know, Harvey Keitel Ed Norton. Yeah. Ed Norton is always hit or miss with me, but I thought he did fine as Will Graham. It's just too bad that it's like a Brett Ratner joint, you know, and because it's just I think Ratner just, you know, it's mediocre. It's just a mediocre film with beautiful production design and a lot of money thrown at it, you know?
Well, not making any effort to make Anthony Hopkins look younger. Like, it just, his appearance, he is too old at that point to be Hannibal.
But the funny thing is, too, is that he looks, kind of disagree a little bit, just because going from that film to Silence of the Lambs, in Silence of the Lambs, he looks weathered. He looks like he's been in fucking incarceration. You know, he's been in prison for a while, 8 years, I think. I remember he says. So he's like a little thinner. He looks a little grayer. It's interesting. And then Silence of the Lambs is what it is. And you know, there's nothing I can bring to the conversation here that hasn't already been discussed. But I mean, I've seen this movie many, many times. But it's Hannibal.
Now you're talking our language. We love this
one. But the funny thing, but here's the thing. I fluctuate on Hannibal because I think Hannibal, I read the book. The book is, again, one of those Thomas Harris, you know, wild card stories where the book is absolutely batshit nuts and includes like bodybuilding sisters, like what's his face? Gary Oldman's character. If I'm blanking on the name,
Mason but Verger. In the book,
he's got this Mason Verger has like a bodybuilding sister. Now imagine if that bodybuilding sister was put into the fucking movie. And she's also responsible for Mason's death, if I recall. But what Ridley Scott does is, again, a ton of money. I mean, like look at the writers, fucking Ted Talion and I got to look up his name. And I can't believe I'm blanking on it, but hang on 1 second. But I mean, like it's everybody came out for it. Like they pulled out all the fucking stops and it's beautifully produced. Oh, fucking David Mamet. Steve Zaillian and David Mamet are the screenwriters.
Yeah.
No, those two at, you know, 2001 are fucking heavy hitters taking on a sequel to Silence of the Lambs and also trying to adapt the kind of crazy freak show that that book is. And I thought, you know, as terms of adaptation, they did completely fine. Like it, it is a, it's an engaging, edgier seat kind of movie. It's grand guignol in nature. And the biggest hiccup I have is Ridley Scott's directing style. Like Scott brings some incredibly strange stylistic choices where I'm like, why did you force process that shot and make it look like it's something that it's not? Why are you making this stylistic choice? Can you just let the camera linger? It was like, you know, Scott, was it post Gladiator, I believe?
Yeah, I think so.
Scott.
It's a lot of that Gladiator stuff. Camera work.
A lot of that Gladiator stuff. Yeah.
Very choppy.
Yeah, but it's like, it's like the biggest, most lavishly produced kind of like gore movie that.
Yeah, it's like a gothic romance.
Yeah. It's so weird. But you know what? The funny thing is, now going through all of those, I kind of lament the demise of big budget procedural movies because once Silence of the Lambs came out, you saw the shift. It was Silence of the Lambs 7, and you saw the shift of movies that we would generally see in the 80s and 90s, which were the police procedural, suddenly start to shift towards television. And so when you've got people sitting in front of their fucking TV all the time watching police procedurals, that takes away the power of the theatrical experience of seeing these types of movies. So like, cause even like there are so many shows today that owe so much to fucking Silence of the Lambs and Bones. I mean, like Bones, but like owes so much to that.
It does because it became those like those stories of the week. This week is this investigation. They did House, which was structured Fringe. The same way. And I mean, even just in the cop world, we had CSI right after that. Law and Order splintered into four different subsections.
Yeah.
Based on the city, like it just exploded the crime drama.
Yeah, and it just made those movies that, you know, like Silence of the Lambs. Kind of renders those movies moot today. Like you can, you don't want to go to a theater to see that because you could turn into fucking, like you said, CSI every week and get that same thrill. But anyways, it was a fun, we did the Scream, you know, quadrilogy not too long ago. Now we finished up the Hannibal. We've just been binging these franchises. We're trying to figure out what to do next.
I'd love to imagine because I did like Julianne Moore. She's fine in it, but it does make your brain race going, oh, what if they had gotten Jodie Foster?
So
what
I have a
history would have been like, you know?
Yeah. So I have a theory. So Jodie Foster obviously turned this down. And so they had to get Julianne Moore, but rewatching Hannibal, I understand why Jodie Foster didn't do it beyond. It's like the kind of madcap grand guignol nature of Hannibal.
Yeah. It's like sleazy.
There's a sleaziness to it, but fucking Clarice Starling is put through the ringer this time around. You know, she's gazed upon, you know, she's dealt with fucking sexist colleagues. There's all like every step of the way she's fighting a battle. Every scene she's fighting a battle against these guys. And it's kind of treading similarly on certain themes that were Jonathan Demme executed so well visually in Silence of the Lambs. So I could see that if, you know, Jodie wanted to come back to, you know, the Clarice role, she would want to see a little bit more evolved, you know, an evolved story of Clarice. And Hannibal doesn't, it feels like Hannibal doesn't want to occupy itself with Clarice's story this time. It wants to focus more on, you know, the Italian investigator Pazzi and Hannibal and stuff like that. So, I mean, like, I do not, you know, I don't blame Jodie for not coming back.
Well, you know, the one thing I wanted to comment on, which ties in at both Hannibal and Hannibal Rising, Ryan, I don't know if you remember when those came out. I was working at Tower Records at the time. Hannibal was kind of, because Silence of the Lambs was so successful, basically Thomas Harris was pressured into these books. So he was kind of working on Hannibal already, but they were literally like, can you finish this book so we can start the movie? And he did, and it was the Hannibal book. And from what I remember, Jodie Foster's like, she hated the ending of the book, which is why she didn't want to do it. Yeah. And then they changed it anyway. But more so, Hannibal Rising was a race to both. Like, he was writing the book and the screenplay simultaneously, and they came out back to back. So I think the final product just suffered just because he was under like pressure, like, well, we're going to make this movie without you. So either finish your book or not, or whatever. So
That's too bad. That's too bad. It is. I mean, he's an incredibly good writer. I just don't, you know, Hannibal Rice.
And I think he has a new book. Did he just put some, he hasn't written anything.
He does.
Since,
yeah.
He's got a new one coming out.
It came out last summer called, I might be mispronouncing it, Carrie Mora. But I'm very, very, it's on my list of things to read. I haven't really been tracking the reviews or anything about it, but it sounded interesting.
Yeah.
And if you're into TV, I've just finished a series called Succession, where you can see Hannibal from Manhunter. Basically, it feels like the same freaking character, because he is a sociopath in the show Succession, even scarier in some ways, because he's like Trump mixed with Rupert Murdoch. But he's such a great performer. I actually like his Hannibal. It's fun. It's different, but
it's just
a different character.
It is. It is very much a different character. And now we're going to move on. I'm going to introduce the girls to the Hannibal Brian Fuller series now. So,
nice.
Yeah. So good.
Yeah. Cool.
Very cool.
Becca, what do you got?
So I'll jump in with one that was recommended to me by my mother, which is something I will never again say. So my mom called, and she mostly watches, I'll call them Lifetime-ish thrillers, is like her jam. And so she calls me and she's like, I saw this great movie on Amazon Prime that you're going to love. And I was like, oh God, she's going to recommend, a Lifetime-ish thrillers, which I do have to I do love those. I mean, I made one last year. I fucking love those. But usually I don't consider them horror. And she was like, there was one I watched last night that just scared the living shit out of me. You have to see it. And, it was one
that she said living shit. Oh my God.
It's a very Southern, scared the living shit out of me. So yeah, it's a very Southern mom thing. But it's called I See You, and it came out in 2019, and it's got Helen Hunt in it.
Yep.
And I had never heard of this in any capacity. Apparently it came up as, like a recommendation on my mom's queue, because I guess Helen Hunt is in a lot of Lifetime films as well. And so it kind of like came up as a recommendation, and she clicked on it because the setup does sound Lifetimey, which again, I love Lifetime films, but it definitely has horror, a lot of horror edge to it. So the setup is, that Helen Hunt and her husband and their teenage son, understand from the very beginning that they're having some type of like family drama. Like Helen Hunt has just cheated on her husband. Her son knows and is all pissed off. And dad is having some type of like issues beyond that. Like they're trying to work through the marriage, but he's got some other jazz going on. Plus dad is an investigator for the police department in their tiny town. And all of these young boys are going missing. They've had this problem before. It happened a couple of decades prior where all of these kids suddenly went missing. And now this person seems to be back, and they don't know what's going on because they arrested somebody for it and he's in jail. So dad, while he's got marital problems at home, is also going through this stuff at work where they think this serial killer has come back. And all of a sudden, weird shit starts happening around their house. Like one day they come home and there's no silverware. Like all their silverware is just gone. And then the next day they come home and the dryer's running and all their silverware's in there. Records will start playing out of nowhere. Things start falling. And so all this weird supernatural shit starts happening around the house. And I'm not going to go past that because it twists so many times. Oh. And I do have there were three main twists in the movie. I did not see any of them coming. Oh, wow. And so it definitely starts off with this kind of supernatural bend, and then it goes in three completely different directions each time. What I think most people will recognize the film for, I'm actually going to put this up on my screen right now, is it has a really good mask in it. Like, and it's weird for me to say that because I hadn't seen a mask this good in a long time. Let me see if I can share my screen so you guys can see this. But and without saying how it gets used or what it gets used for. Nope, my screen's just gonna lock up. But it's got a really good mask in it after the film gets going and you figure out, you know, what's going on. But yeah, overall, I really enjoyed this. I have no idea where it played, if this was like a TV movie or if this did any type of theatrical. It was pretty fun. I do have to say it wasn't a perfect film. Oh, here it is. Okay, I'm sharing this with you guys. Can you see this? I'm trying here.
I'm staring into the black void of Becca's soul.
Yeah.
There it is.
It's like a doll. It looks like a doll. But
it won't tell you. I won't tell you what it is yet because it becomes crucial to the plot. But yeah, it does have just this really dope looking mask that becomes part of it.
Like a dead frog or something.
Yeah, but I do. This was relatively well reviewed. I was kind of shocked because, again, I hadn't heard of it. But when I started like looking through Letterboxd and Rotten Tomatoes and IMDb, it was a lot of people just going, this had really nice tension. And then a lot of people going, this was boring. It is slow. I will say it is slow moving. But yeah, I had fun with it. So that is I See You.
That's awesome. I'm glad you saw it because I've been it's been in my Amazon Prime queue for like the longest time and I've seen it.
Yeah, it's on Prime right now.
Yeah. No, that's cool. I'll check it out.
Yeah, I will say it's not like it does not turn into horror exactly the way that most of us think of it, and even on IMDb it's called a psychological thriller horror. Right. And so it is definitely a psychological thriller first with a lot of horror woven into it. Right. So yeah, definitely check it out. I See You.
Very cool. So I took advantage of a recent Warner Archive sale to pick up a few horror titles that either I hadn't seen or just have always wanted to. And so I've got the Blu-ray here for Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, the original made-for-TV movie from 1973, I think. I know Guillermo del Toro produced a remake of this not too long ago with Katie Holmes. But this is the original, which I'd never seen, and I know a lot of people talk about it as kind of one of those kinder trauma movies, like something that scarred them. Yeah. I'd never seen it. I thought it was pretty excellent. This Blu-ray looks terrific. It's
I'm sorry, Rob. Becca's running around. We're watching just so the listeners are aware, we're all on Zoom. Becca just jumped out of her chair and then she started running around the room chasing something off camera, and then she started throwing clothes around. Oh, now she's sitting down. Okay.
And saying the word animal.
Everybody act normal. Rob, what were you watching?
I don't know. I was looking down, so I didn't see what ran into the room. Was it a child or a dog?
I look over, so I have a pile of laundry behind me, and I'm just like glancing around, and I look over, and Poe literally has my hoodie and has chewed the arm off of it.
It was a dog.
It was the dog.
I was kind of hoping it was Strummer, like just diving in your laundry. That would have been better.
No. That was me trying. Okay, I caught her. As soon as I stopped moving, I'm going to put her back. Hold on. Nope. Be right there.
That's amazing.
Dog invasion. It's okay. So this is a made-for-TV 1973 movie. It's a lean 74 minutes. Obviously, I'm sure they showed it with commercials and all that. Kim Darby is in it. Very young, post the original True Grit, but pre Better Off Dead. Her and her husband inherit this mansion. They move in. They go downstairs. There's like a handyman kind of fixing the place up. And the chimney downstairs is totally blocked off. And she keeps hearing these little voices there. And when she kind of digs back in there, there's these little creatures that are kind of scurrying around the house and saying really fucked up shit to her. Like, we're going to get you. We're going to not. Tomorrow, we're going to get you. And you're like, wait what?
I missed the title. What was the title of this?
The original Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. And they look like little prune people or something. like they have like little pumpkin faces or something. They're scary as shit. They just, the attacks keep getting more intense in the middle. They're kind of like sensitive to light, so they only come out at nighttime. And obviously nobody believes her at first. She's like, I think there's something wrong with this house that we just moved into. And it's pretty cool, and it goes to some pretty dark places for a TV movie. And it's interesting. I really liked it a lot. Had I been a child when this aired on TV, it would have scarred me for life.
It's one of the big ones people talk about, right? Like in terms of kinder trauma. I've never seen this one. And I saw Guillermo's not this one, but I always hear from people this is the big one.
If you're like 10 years old and you see these little prune things like saying like, we're going to get you tomorrow for sure. You're just like, what? Oh my God, this is crazy. So this was actually a wonderful little gem and a great little discovery. The Blu-ray looks fantastic. It's like a flawless version of it. I don't know if bootlegs have floated around for years now, but this is a great Warner Archive release. They normally don't do special features, but this one actually has like three different audio commentaries with people like Steve Barton, Uncle Creepy from Dread Central, Jeffrey Reddick, who's on our show, creator of Final Destination, did a commentary on here. So it's pretty cool. But this is, yeah, it's definitely a gem. If you haven't seen it, I would recommend the original Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
Yeah, I'm curious to see that one. I got a couple of just real quick other new ones I saw. I was quite a big fan of a movie a couple of years ago. In fact, They Look Like People was one of those indies that popped up that actually really helped inspire me to write something to just make, you know, like something that you can just get done, which, you know, hopefully will still happen when all this lifts. But he's got a new film, Perry Blackshear, and I just didn't even know he had a new film made in a similar vein. It's not, I wouldn't call it a bigger film. I'd say it's a similar scale, called The Siren, which is unfortunate because there's so many films with that title. It's very hard.
Yeah, it had a different title when I initially saw it, but yeah, it was released as The Siren.
It's, well, for those who follow my favorite podcast of the last couple of years was that that special series on Val Lewton, and one of the stories that Val Lewton wrote, I can't remember the name, it's not Krakatoan or whatever it is, but it's the name, the Valatruska, it's a famous myth, that was the title.
And yeah, that's it.
And that's actually what the creature is. And I was like, when I heard that, I was like, oh, that's so much better. Anyway, it sounds like a, you know, it's a word that doesn't have a meaning. So maybe they struggled with that. But it's all the same team. So it's kind of cool to see this production model. It's the same three actors from the first film in different roles. It follows a mute man who rents a lakeside cabin. And he meets this other guy who's in the cabin next door, who is a widower because his husband has been killed. And he's out for revenge because he knows something drowned it in the lake. And then the mute guy, of course, meets this very beautiful woman who's constantly all day, every day swimming in the lake. And she is not a mermaid. At first, I thought it was, I texted Becca straight away. I was like, I think there's a mermaid film.
Yeah, he was like, there's a mermaid movie by the guy who did They Look Like People. And I looked it up and I was like, no, that's not.
I was glad it wasn't a mermaid one because we had just had the Great Polish, you know, the lure and stuff like that, and the lighthouse and all that. So you don't get too much of a story on her, but she is. You know, it's a very dark kind of view of her, and there's these great scenes where she seems kind of caring and like she's going to do something good, and then suddenly the dark kind of demon side take over. And there's a really dark scene where she swims up to a little girl, and just the way it's shot is quite disturbing. Not even what happens; it's actually just the way they frame it, which tells you. Like I always think for indie filmmakers, you look at these movies and it is inspiring. The start of it, what's funny, it actually doesn't open with the mute guy coming to the house; it opens with the guy who's been wronged, and it's almost beat for beat the what's the one where we had the director on where it's the guy in the other country with the knight trying to kill it's the same feeling. Like it literally opens with a guy with a huge beard at a lake trying to writing down thoughts and narrating voiceover, but then it opens up its story. But I liked it, you know. It's very simple, you know. Nothing happened in it that, you know, my jaw never dropped to the floor, but I was constantly interested in the kind of human, very human qualities all three characters, including the creature, have. And movies like that are always interesting.
That's cool.
The Siren, and that one's on Amazon, and worth a look, especially if that sounds like your jam. And then the last one I saw that I know a lot of people will be exposed to because it's hit Shudder is called Blood Quantum by director Jeff Barnaby. And this is basically a Native American reservation story take on an outbreak / you know, zombie apocalypse type movie. And it's really well made. It's obviously super refreshing to see a totally different group of people and different faces on screen dealing with something we've seen 1,001 times. What I was telling you guys before this started, I won't go deep into it because I know you're probably all going to see it. I will say that the first 15 minutes was just so my jam. Like it was basically Wreck. It was like Wreck on a reservation. And I was so excited about it. Even the character, everything about it was just so well made that I wanted to keep watching that movie. And after about 15 minutes, it cuts ahead to being much more of an Apocalypse Walking Dead type story. And so for me, that story has played out so much that whilst it's still a fresh view on it, it's still not enough for me, but there's still lots of good moments. Definitely worth checking out and, you know, make up your own mind. But man, just watch the first 10 minutes regardless, because I was just in. It really takes its time for the first few minutes, and then it just hits the gas when these things start happening, and which is fun. So, you know, it's always exciting to see, you know, fresh voices. And that's what we need, a lot more of that. And Shudder Hopton is doing it.
Yeah, I have to add the siren. I kind of dismissed it based on the artwork when I first saw it, but I didn't.
Yeah, that does look very generic.
Yeah. But knowing it's Perry Blackshear, I'll definitely tune in. Is that all you got over?
Yeah. That's all the new stuff. Yeah.
I was up at 1 a.m. and I couldn't sleep a couple of nights ago. So I revisited a film that I haven't seen in a very, very long time, because I feel like due to my career as a horror journalist, I had watched this one quite a bit. Plus it was just a great time and a nice boom for horror and refreshing new voices. Cabin Fever, Eli Roth's Cabin Fever.
Oh, wow.
I haven't seen it since that.
I haven't seen it since that period, And, you know, it is a, you know, and I realized pretty much like Silence of the Lambs, although I feel like it's like, you know, revisiting Silence of the Lambs is like eating vegetables. Revisiting Cabin Fever is like eating a pint of ice cream. It is, you know, I don't know if I need to see it again, because I just know that movie by heart. You know, there's some very questionable, problematic shit that doesn't probably hold up today.
I watched it a couple of months ago, and it does not hold up well.
There's some stuff that doesn't, stuff that doesn't quite hold water today. But it is a deeply entertaining, fun, movie of a bunch of friends who go to a cabin and contract a flesh-eating disease. And very interesting that, you know, I decided to watch it during this time. You know, everybody's really fun in it. You know, and it's definitely one of those movies that's just like a beacon of, you know, it's a calling card for a new voice. And it definitely comes across that way. And, you know, there's some unevenness to it, you know, that where you're like, no, that there's some inconsistencies in terms of tone, that, you know, the pancake stuff that, you know, back then it felt like, oh man, that's so wild, dude. The kid just started screaming pancakes. Now, like, you know, however many years later, you're kind of like, okay, that's weird. But
yeah, let's, you know, just
in the grand scheme of things, it's kind of doesn't hold up.
Let's just all remember that summer where people just went around yelling pancakes and we all thought it was hilarious. That it was a whole thing.
I don't know if that sounds like an interesting.
Oh my god! Yeah,
fascinated by your
god. I remember all my horror friends at the time just doing that.
Yeah, we got Becca. We only got like slivers of
voice.
We got really big voice.
So kind of like Mr. Roboto. I said, for a minute.
Wow. No, I said, can we all just take a break to remember that month when all of our horror friends would yell pancakes and everybody thought it was fucking hilarious. It was just a thing. Yeah.
I think that was his David Lynch influence, really, because he didn't even work.
Well, that was it. Yeah, very much so. Yes.
Right up until that movie. Yeah. He was his assistant for like 5 years.
Yeah.
Has anyone
seen a lot of David? Yeah.
Has anyone seen the remake from 2016, I think? Yeah. It's they remade it like exactly the same.
Yeah.
Like the same script and everything.
There's some weird, shady businesses dealings that I think were fueling that. I don't go on a record saying that, but I mean, like, you know, and I don't know what I'm talking about, but that's what I presumed when it came out and they announced it.
Yeah. I mean, they made what, like four of them? There's like three sequels and a remake, and it's kind of like
They did the Ty West sequel, and then they made two more, and then you know, another company announced it was doing this remake, and I felt like, you know, from my understanding, it was kind of similar to someone, you know, it was similar to like Romero spearheading the 1990 remake of Night of the Living Dead. It was like, let us reclaim it, make some money, you know. And I feel like for some of the people that were involved in the Cabin Fever remake, that's all it was just to make some money, you know. And
interesting,
and because it just felt like very weird. It just felt very strange for almost 10 years later, just a remake to pop up out of nowhere. That's almost like shot for shot. I don't know. I'm just theorizing. But yeah, so we watched that, and then I tossed on Terror Vision, which is always just a great late night movie to throw on, and it's
it's one of my favorite moments in any movie. It's so just good.
So good. So good. Yeah.
Did you know, what's
that?
Did you, I had no clue. You probably know this because I never knew this back in the day when I first saw Terrorvision and I looked up Ted Nicola. I had no idea he was the sound guy on Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah. Yes, I somehow knew that.
Yeah, wow. The director of that back then was, I mean, he did a lot of stuff, obviously, for the band. Yeah. He's a good director. He did the one of the ones with the vampires as well. But
Subspecies,
which is really well directed.
Subspecies
being on that,
Subspecies 1 is actually pretty good. It's a decent vampire movie. Yeah.
It's got some good art direction and weird, you know, effects.
Yeah, and Terrorvision is, I mean, like, Terrorvision... you know, rewatching it now, like it's super limited by its budget because it's like you watch Gary Graham go in the backyard and all of a sudden they're completely on a soundstage where they didn't bother. The backdrop is just painted blue, like a dark blue, and you're like, oh, so it's the Sesame Street set. Got it. But the monster's really fun. The swinging parents. It's just
actually
like,
surprised we didn't bring it up last week because of the Horror Host connection. We
were talking about you're right.
That's a fun thing, yeah.
Also, a Diane Franklin all glammed out.
Oh, God, with the hair. So funny. That's awesome.
So funny, yeah. Anyways.
Well, I watched two more that were super, super goopy. One was not my jam, but Rob, if I remember correctly, you liked this. This is the remake of Blood Feast that came out a couple of years ago.
No, I haven't seen this yet. Yeah, I haven't seen that one.
Oh, never mind. I thought for some reason that one of my friends had really liked this. Not my jam. So yeah, this is a remake of the 1960s Herschel Gordon Lewis Blood Feast. And this one came out in 2016. It stars Robert Ressler and Carolyn Williams, both of whom I love. But for some reason, this did not gel for me. The whole concept of it is that Fuad Ramsey's they've picked up from America. They moved the whole place to France. So it's now an American diner in France. And then Robert Ressler's character can't get the diner going. He plays the guy who owns the diner. So he also works at a museum as a security guard, which is confusing already. But then while at the museum, he falls in love with this goddess Ishtar and then starts using the diner to kill people, to sacrifice and create the blood feast.
Sounds for more
Ishtar.
Like Blood Diner.
Yeah.
Blood Diner is a remake of Blood Feast.
It's just weird that this one sounds more like Blood Diner than it does Blood Feast. It's like
it does. Yeah. It feels, I had tonal issues with this where at times it felt like they were making it self-aware. Like they were definitely kind of, you know, winking at, you know, that Blood Feast was this B movie. Very much so that like what I thought the Thousand Maniacs remake did well is that it was aware of kind of how, you know, what the Herschel Gordon Lewis movies were. But then there are other times that it takes it dead serious. And so it just never really connected with me. But the gore was great. The gore was awesome in it.
It made Rob's top 10 of that year, I remember.
I thought it did for some reason. Rob loved it.
What if like The Stand, we all had similar dreams and our similar dreams were that Rob really liked it?
No, Rob, we all know you loved it.
We all dreamt.
That's very convenient, Rob, that you haven't
seen. I love Blood Diner. I mean, you know, Kong is king.
I love Blood Diner as well. Then again, I was reading some reviews where people were like, oh, this is amazing. So what the fuck do I know? It's got good gore. But then I also watched another movie with good gore that just did not quite gel for me. But this one was recommended by a bunch of listeners on the Shockwaves fan group were asking me if I'd ever seen Proteus before. And this is from 1995. And this totally felt like a movie that I should have seen. Ryan, have you seen Proteus?
I saw it. Yeah. When I worked at Blockbuster, it came in and I had to watch it immediately.
So yeah, this felt, as soon as I read the descriptor, I was like, why the fuck have I never seen this? And so I immediately had to watch it. The setup is a group of heroin smugglers are doing this drug deal. It goes horribly wrong. They are on this speedboat trying to get away from the drug deal. Something goes horribly wrong with the speedboat. And then they end up in a life raft. And then they wash up to this oil rig. and it's completely deserted. And they're like, holy shit, we found a deserted oil rig. Let's loot this bitch. But then what they find out that it's not actually an oil rig. It is a cover for a biological lab that is doing tests on creatures. Mm. And then it becomes the thing on a boat. But that kind of oversells it a bit. There is a really cool goopy monster at the end. But it took a lot of willpower to get there. So yeah, it literally is the thing on the boat where the creature embodies itself in people that look like people. So it's just, it's the basic setup, but you only get that really big monster payoff at the end. But then it does get really goopy. So if you want some crazy fun 90s big giant aquatic monster aesthetics, the last 10 minutes are awesome.
I think Chuck from Letterboxd put it best. Let me just read the start of Chuck's email. This is how he writes about this movie. Thank you, Chuck. My wife and I got married with no money and no plan. We met, split up, got back together, and we're married all within one in a year half span. Quickly had our first child. We were essentially poor in those first 2 years and had no way to watch anything that came out until a close friend brought me a laptop. In the first 2 months of our marriage, I figured how to steal movies off the internet on the laptop, but I could only seem to download on popular ones. So that's what we watched. Proteus is the first movie we watched as a married couple together. Oh, and so begins Chuck's venture into reviewing, which is like 2 pages long. Thank God for Chuck.
I'm glad that Chuck got to see it. So yeah.
I hope somebody puts a piano score under my review there. But
it does have Doug Bradley in it. Okay. That's all I got.
Cool.
If you're an aquatic horror completionist, watch it. Otherwise, the last 10 minutes are kind of cool.
I've seen it once.
Wow. I think it's plenty.
I will say what Beckett just said about the last 10 minutes. Chuck agrees. He says, I recommend the last 15 minutes of this flick, and I love my wife. That's what it ends with. So, bless you, Chuck, wherever in quarantine you are.
You know what? I actually like this. We should all come to the table next week with a review that we found on Letterboxd.
Rather enjoyable.
I think we need to start reading Letterboxd reviews and find like the funniest ones.
That's great.
Brian's done this before. Brian's picked some good ones, so I have to give kudos. But I do like this idea. For horror, you get with the old horror. I think you get some better ones. You know.
Thanks, Chuck.
Whoever you are,
we're here for you. We're glad that Proteus brought you guys closer as a couple.
Amazing.
Wow. All right. Well, before we dive into our night flight pick of the week.
Yes.
Another shout out to 50 States of Fright, which I've been watching on my phone before bed, putting headphones on. You don't need a giant TV in front of your to watch these. I know this is a bold statement. I like these better than Creepshow. I think 50 States of Fright is very well produced and very polished. The money is there on the screen, even if it's a small screen. Obviously, Sam Raimi kicked off the first three, which was The Golden Arm. I just watched. Ryan, do you know the director of the Ball of Twine one, which was in Kansas?
Yeah.
I've not heard of her.
I pulled her up. I know the writer.
I
dropped her name last week.
So it was written by May Catt.
Oh, I was going to say Yoko Okumura.
Yes. I mean, excellent. Excellent. They're really well made and really dark. Well, at least that one was the one that she directed. And then I just finished the Ryan Spindel one. Ryan Spindel did the Mortuary Collection and was on our show for anthologies. And his was a blast, like really fun and funny, which I didn't see coming at all. It's James Ranscone. Is that his name from Sinister 2?
Yeah.
He's excellent in it and it goes creature feature. And I was like, whoa. Again, I don't mean to keep comparing it to Creepshow, but it's basically what I wished the Creepshow show was this.
How long are the episodes?
Well, they're mostly
some.
Well, yeah. In total, they're about 20 minutes, but they're broken up either into two or three parts, and each part is like 5 minutes long. So, but what's cool about it is they're even cliffhanger-ish. So like, you watch this 5 minute bit, and then it ends on a cliffhanger, and you're like, well, all right, I'll watch the next segment. So they're all like pretty much done in like almost like three acts, very short. And they're a lot of fun. I mean, they're great. And I haven't gotten to the ones that just dropped, which are Alejandro Bruje, who's on our show. Yeah. Bruje's from Nightmare Cinema and Juan of the Dead. But I'm looking forward to jumping into that. So I think these are actually really terrific. And again, I signed up for Quibi for free for 3 months, specifically just to watch this. So, yeah, I think they're great and they're definitely worthwhile.
They are enjoyable. Yeah, I watched the first two parts of Alejandro's last night, which is also conceived by Eduardo Sanchez and Greg Hale.
Cool.
So, yeah, it's fun. They're a lot of fun. They're you know, you kind of get engrossed in it, and after 6 minutes, they all of a sudden are like, "We're done." It's cool. I want to ask you, Rob, how do you watch it? Do you hold it up in front of your face and like just lay in bed, or
I lay in bed, I hold it, you know, widescreen.
Have you been so tired that you let the phone drop on your face like I have?
No, not yet. I'm not that tired.
I'm watching it, and Ciara's generally watch it, and all of a sudden she caught me. I had to catch the phone because it was flying towards my face. And she's like, "Ryan, it's time to go to bed." I'm like, fine.
But just one more 50 States of Fright.
Yeah. Go ahead, Beck.
I was just going to say their model it's really intriguing as a writer because I pitched on a different show that Quibi is doing, and the way that they would set it up when they're talking about like how they want it to feel is even though that you're looking at a show and they want it as a three-act structure, right, within each one of those acts, they want a three-act structure. So within each 5 minutes, they want it to feel like a three. So it's literally like shrinking it down. Yeah. It's complicated to describe, but it's an interesting way to think about it. So as you are writing, you are thinking about it's going to be divided up into three parts.
Right.
So you're not even just working towards commercial breaks. You're thinking them as mini episodes within an episode.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
It keeps it going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We should give a shout out to Sam Raimi, who actually narrates the opening titles.
Yes.
Right. Which is always, every time I was like, oh, finally, he's doing his Rod Serling shtick, you know?
Ryan, I think you posted today. Yeah. Did you see, Gray Fox, Bruce Campbell, like with this like gray beard that he puts up today?
I want to see Old Man Ash. Yeah, no. Here's a funny little. Okay, so Ciara goes bicycling today. She comes back, and I was like, "Hey, honey, I just like retweeted Old Man Ash," and I said, "By the way, what I mean by that is Bruce Campbell posted a picture of him with this like white beard." She goes, "Without me finishing my sentence," she goes, "Oh, I saw the photo," and I was like, "Should I talk anymore?" She goes, "No, he looks great." And I was like, oh, well, fine. I just want to do a quick shout out to Shudder, who brought Joe Bob Briggs back for his second season of The Last Drive-In last Friday. Welcomed Chopping Mall to the Joe Bob Briggs stable and a film called Bloodsucking Freaks, which I could not get through.
Oh, the original? Is there a remake?
No, this is the original.
There's only one.
There's the original. He had Chris Jericho come out because Chris Jericho is apparently a big, you know, big fan. It was fun seeing Joe Bob go through Joe, you know, the whole chopping mall thing, and he brought in Kelly Maroney, and it was fun to hear some anecdotes and Joe Bob's commentary in spite of him giving it, I believe, 2.5 stars. But once Bloodsucking, I've never seen Bloodsucking Freaks, but what the fucking fuck is that movie? Deeply uncomfortable, deeply unsettling, probably the biggest piece of shit I've ever seen. I got about 15 minutes in and I was like, I can't do this at all. I don't know. Chris Jericho's out of his mind. I'm sorry, dude. Elric, have you never seen this movie?
I think when I was like 17, we rented it, and I don't know if I ever got through it either. I remember not like I was in that Herschel Gordon Lewis period, and then it wasn't even on that par. You know,
it's just like it's just fucking misogyny reigning supreme and just endless female torture to the nth degree. It's deeply unpleasant, and I don't even know what the narrative is, but it's like some fucking weird mustache dude and an assistant who systematically just torture women and, you know, fully naked tortured women and suck their brains and do all this shit.
Yeah. It's Herschel Gordon Lewis sans the whimsy.
Yeah.
It's like in theater, there's this term that came out of the surrealism movement of theater of torture or theater of cruelty, where it's all about trying to make the audience uncomfortable and shocked and kind of abhorrent at what they're watching. And this is like the film version of theater of cruelty. So yeah, it's like you just spend the whole movie kind of going, ugh, and you're not comfortable. And I don't think I've ever been able to get through it. I've seen chunks of it.
But, yeah, I'm good. But I'm very curious to see what Joe Bob brings this week. By the time you listen to this episode on Friday, he's going to have Tom Savini on. So excited to see what happens. What's on Night Flight, guys?
Night Flight. So guys, this week our Night Flight title was selected by Elric, but totally endorsed by all of us. And I think I already told him that he looks like him tonight. So I'm sorry. No, oh, thank you. No, I said you look like Zito.
Wings Hauser.
Because you do have a very Joe Spinell thing going on right now.
Wait. If I have Joe Spinell thing going on, then we have a problem. Because
you were talking about how sweaty you are,
Elric. You're not Joe Spinell in a knit ski cap and big jacket with a shotgun, Joe Spinell. You are. I'm going out to dinner with Carol Monroe.
That one. You're the slightly nicer looking, still like a little sweaty and unnerved Frank Zito character. So.
As I told Becca on her Patreon for her other show, we were talking about Slaughter High, and I was talking about how Carolyn Monroe was 36 playing an 18-year-old.
Yes.
And that is where my first crush developed, because I saw Slaughter High. I think it's my first slasher film. So I was in love with Carolyn Monroe well before I got to Maniac. So I don't mean I've been dressed up for dinner for her for a long time.
So Maniac 1980, now available on Night Flight. This is one that we love. I mean, can you love this movie?
I think you can.
I do. I love this movie.
Okay. This is definitely one that I will watch just about any time. This is Bill Lustig. Have we had him on this show? I know he was on Killer POV.
Not on Chocolate.
Yeah, he hasn't been on this yet, but we'll work on it.
Oh, wow. We should work on that. That seems like an oversight. But yeah, guys, Maniac. When did you guys first see it?
I can't recall my first time seeing Maniac, but I will recall the most pleasant experience seeing Maniac is because they just did the restoration of it and they played it at Fantastic Fest, and I missed the public screening of it. So they had a press and industry screening at 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning, and I got my ass up super early and grabbed a cup of coffee and had the theater all to myself and just enjoyed Maniac in beautiful, pristine 4K. And it was quite the eye-opening experience, but it also just gave me a renewed appreciation for more than anything, the fucking color design of that film. I mean, like from the production design of in the set deck of, you know, of his apartment to just the seediness of New York. I think there is value to Maniac, believe it or not. I think it's a very well-made movie.
Yes, it is. Yeah, that's what I always look at Maniac as, is it maybe this kind of rough subject matter, and it definitely, you know, there's some it shows its edges and it's grimy and gritty, but there's really good filmmaking behind this one. Like it has just got some beautiful setups and shots and everything. Well, and really good acting.
Yeah. And going back to what, you know, kind of going back to the Hannibal conversation and how the procedural kind of ruined the procedural on television, ruined the theatrical experience of procedural movies. You know, I feel like when weighed against what people watch on television, on CSI and, you know, all those other kind of cop shows, the shit that goes on in Maniac is no different. I mean, it honestly is, you know, it's like, oh, my mom, I'm tortured by my, you know, I'm dealing with trauma and I'm killing women. Like, that is no different than what you're watching on fucking CSI. The only thing that Maniac has is just this kind of built-in griminess that makes you feel like you gotta take a shower, whereas CSI is incredibly slick and filtering to the stay-at-home moms that watch CSI. There's a little bit of slickness to it. But, you know, the subject matter is no different. It's just a fucking analysis of a fucking psychopath.
And it's another one of those ones that got a lot of protests against it based on largely the poster, which is just one of the most outrageous posters ever with the woman's severed head and a clearly an erection. But it's funny because for saying that's like so misogynistic on the surface, it's really like if you get to the end of these types of movies and you really can watch it for what it is, you go, oh, what is it actually saying? And like the ending of this movie is pretty fucking brutal towards the misogynist and himself. And it's, I feel like some of these, that's what I love about horror. I think they're often quite complicated in how we feel and what their ideas are. And it's not just one thing. And so I think this one is particularly loaded like that. Also partially, I think, because of Spinell's, like, not just his great performance, but also some of the writing that really, you know, humanizes him. So you kind of try to understand him. You work to understand him a bit better, which I think is really good. He's great. It just is so fun to watch and everything.
Yeah.
And now that Becca says I look like him, I guess I'll just...
Only because you were sweaty.
I'll never look at Rocky the same.
Well, guys, this one is available on Night Flight this week. Night Flight Plus is a streaming channel available on Roku, Apple TV, Amazon Fire TV, and online. The channel is the only place to watch original episodes of iconic 80s cult series Night Flight, which we all loved, as well as eclectic collections of cult films, music documentaries, midnight movies, concert films, and more. Subscriptions are only $4.99 a month or $39.99 a year. For a limited time, Shockwave listeners can save $10 on annual memberships with the promo code SHOCKWAVES, one word, which comes out to less than $2.50 a month. So go there now and check out Maniac, as well as some of our other titles that we have plugged. Death Dream. We've had a bunch of them. We did Stage Fright.
Society.
Society. So just across the board, they've got some just amazing titles on there. And check out the original Night Flight show as well. I have had just as much fun watching the original Night Flight show as I have watching all of these fantastic movies. It's just full of gems.
I agree.
Excellent.
All right. Well, we're going to hear from our sponsors again. Yep. And we will be back with the gentleman behind Vinegar Syndrome.
I seem to be having some microphone problems, guys.
Well, if we don't hear from you again, Becca, we'll see you next week.
Becca, maybe we'll hear some other sounds coming from your mic. Maybe.
Stay safe, guys.
Severin Films presents the complete Umberto Lenzi Carol Baker Giallo Collection Blu-ray box set that includes four Blu-rays of Orgasmo, So Sweet, So Perverse, A Quiet Place to Kill, and Knife of Ice, never before on disc in America, plus two CDs of soundtrack music from all four films, all starring Carol Baker and directed by Umberto Lenzi. Orgasmo contains both the unrated director's cut and the U.S. release X-rated cut under the title Paranoia. Each disc comes with an exclusive video interview with the late, great Umberto Lenzi, plus audio commentaries from Italian genre film scholars. The complete Umberto Lenzi Carol Baker Giallo Collection, Orgasmo, So Sweet, So Perverse, A Quiet Place to Kill, and Knives of Ice, 6-disc box set available for pre-order right now over at www.severin-films.com. And also available now on demand, the award-winning Severin Films production, Blood and Flesh, The Real Life and Ghastly Death of Al Adamson.
For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers around the world. Diabolik offers a one-stop shopping experience for all of your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabre, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Their latest arrivals include from Arrow Video, the complete Gamera collection and Beyond the Door, from Cauldron Films, Abracadabra and American Rickshaw, and from Scream Factory, Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. Whether you're looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you have been craving. Shop online at DiabolikDVD.com, and that's Diabolik with a K.
It's a little crazy out there right now, so Fangoria is offering a free 2-month digital membership to everyone. Go to Fangoria.com for more information to make an account. Then pore over all the exclusive articles, interviews, and reviews on the site, as well as original video content and podcasts. You'll even have access to high-resolution scans of the first 15 issues of the original run of Fangoria magazine and counting. Go to Fangoria.com now to start your free digital membership. And if you're looking to add to your social distancing watch list, Fangoria's latest movie, VFW, is now available to stream on demand, and Satanic Panic is streaming on Shudder now.
Okay, so we're back. This is the brave new world that is Shockwave's remote quarantine edition. And we are welcoming back. These could be the guests that have been on the show more than any other at this point, I think. From Vinegar Syndrome, Jeff Cattell and Joe Rubin. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you. Hello.
What's up, dudes?
We're so excited to be our third time doing this show.
Yeah.
And we're super excited for halfway to Black Friday sale. Obviously, it's too bad we can't do any conventions or anything. We always look forward to seeing everybody. But this halfway to Black Friday sale will be incredible, May 22nd through the 25th.
Excellent. And what have you guys been up to since last we had you on? Because I think it was probably before like Halloweenish time, if I can't remember exactly.
It was April. About a year ago.
Oh, my God. Okay, a whole year. Okay, you guys have been busy.
Yes. We obviously have been putting out a lot of titles, and you've seen Black Friday, the success of last Black Friday with Tammy and the T-Rex and Spookies. Everyone loves Spookies.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, the one title that Joe and I love the most, Candy Snatchers, people probably weren't as familiar with it. I hope to rectify that tonight.
Yeah.
That's my favorite, man. That's like probably my favorite title you guys have done.
Yeah, it's incredible. Joe and I can both remember when that DVD first came out, you know, over 15 years ago, and then you couldn't find it anywhere. So it was a huge deal to release it on Blu-ray, and I think people were just kind of like, they were so into Spookies and they were so into Tammy, they may have forgotten about Candy Snatchers. And I really want Candy Snatchers to sell out for this halfway to Black Friday sale, for the slip.
Was there an issue with Candy Snatchers that kept it off of Blu-ray for this entire time period? Or, you know, like basically it was one of those coveted titles that I know Elric talked about quite a bit. And it was a pleasant surprise when you guys announced it. So was it difficult to get to that point?
Yeah, somewhat. It's the people or the person who owns it isn't really in the film business, and she's not really, she hadn't really sought out distribution. Mm-hmm. And it kind of came to us through a friend of mine who also loves the film and had really done a lot of work to convince her that it deserved to be out and that we could give it the love that it needed. And I think she has been happy about it. I'd love to see more audience response to it, as Jeff said. But it's a wonderful film, and I will throw out that one of our surprise titles coming for the halfway sale has a Candy Snatchers or several Candy Snatchers connections.
Oh wow. And you know what, Joe? Jeff, you're usually kind of my go-to guy when I ask questions about these titles. But you know, I'd heard Elric talk about Candy Snatchers quite a bit, and that kind of falls in the 70s horror cycle.
And it's not even necessarily a horror movie. It's so many things. It's like kind of a kidnapping crime movie. It's a biting satire about capitalism. It's like an off-the-wall avant-garde kind of like comedy in a lot of ways, in terms of having some wacky hijinks in it and some just the best characters across the board, like side characters only have like one scene, just like stick in your memory forever. There's just no other movie like it.
One of the best stories I heard when I first got to LA was I met Darren Bousman for the first time on one of these kind of shows I was doing, and he told a story of being at a Hollywood party and Quentin Tarantino comes up to him and somehow brings up Candy Snatchers. And Darren goes, yeah, I've seen Candy Snatchers, totally lying, having never heard of it. And then got himself in a very intricate conversation where at a certain point, he knew it was apparent that Quentin could tell he hadn't seen Candy Snatchers. And I always thought about that story. That's the problem with Hollywood.
Once you see it, you know, you can't ever forget.
You can't fudge that movie. It's pretty simple.
And if you ask somebody, and if you told somebody about it and walked them through point by point, they'd be like, that's not a real movie. Yeah. There's no way. And that's why it's so shocking to me that it's just like, why are you people buying this thing and like totally loving it and bringing it back to the front of the line in a lot of ways? Like, this is a movie that deserves to, you know, be at the, because even that DVD, when that first came out and then it was gone, it like went out of print almost immediately. it became like a legendary like people were like, have you seen Candy Snatchers? And it just like, and people like, no. And it's like, I know a guy who knows a guy who has a copy. You should see it. And that's how it kind of developed that cult life when it first appeared.
I watched, so when Ann Timpson had he must have borrowed or had a print of it back in the day, a long time ago now. And I saw that. But here, I guess what I would think is, like, I know you guys also work with AGFA a lot. This is the kind of title where I just wonder if people just don't know what it is always. And I wonder if we could do, when screenings come back, if it's screened a couple times here and there, I feel like that could get quite a lot of buzz about it because it is a controversial picture to watch probably in a group more than just at home. I don't know if you guys are able to do that with the kind of deals you license. I don't know how that works.
It's case by case. This one's a bit complicated, but a screening could probably be arranged in some capacity.
We're down.
Definitely a fun film to watch with an audience, and I guess maybe fun isn't the right word, but I've seen it with an audience twice, and it packs a good punch.
Wow. Yeah, because it's a weird tone. It tonal shifts between really bleak and actually quite funny and goofy. I like it a lot.
And fantastic and really well written. It's a really well made, well written movie. Like, and I know we do a lot of regional stuff or a lot of kind of like underground stuff, but Candy Snatchers is a legitimately great movie made by professionals on every level, And it's one of those movies that screams 70s. And I know, and Joe and I kind of have conversations where it's like, there seems to be maybe a little bit of shift towards people who like more of the 80s stuff, the video store days and the 90s cable days. But that 70s should not be forgotten. And Candy Snatchers is probably the best 70s title we've released.
I discovered a really good Western last year that I hadn't seen before called The Last Hard Men. And when I got to the credits, of course, Greerden Trueblood came up. So the director of Candy Snatchers wrote it. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize he had had that. When you say professionals, I didn't know that when I saw Candy Snatchers. I didn't realize he had had a real writing career.
Oh, yeah. Just a very and a solid one of those guys that just kind of like that just kicked around. Hollywood at that time in the television, there's so many of those guys that kind of like, they got like a little bit of lead in, they got a little bit of heat and they were able to do something or they were able to be like, I'm stuck doing this and they totally do something different. And it's like, that's exactly what Gordon Trueblood is. It's like somebody who just kind of like, the dude had a life, he was making money and he's just like, I just got to do this, and that's what Candy Snatchers became.
It's a shame Becca's not on right now because he also wrote Ants, The Savage Bees, and a film called Tarantulas. So that's her, and Jaws 3D. That's her like sweet spot, but she's not here.
the last time you and I had breakfast, I'm always curious about kind of fan spending habits and what they respond to. And part of the reason I know you wanted to talk about Candy Snatchers is it seems like the 70s titles are a little bit of a blind spot for the average buyer, whereas something like Tammy and the T-Rex did really great for you guys. So I don't know. I was wondering if you can just maybe fill us in on what you've noticed being kind of like the hot titles since the last time you guys were on. And which ones you would recommend that maybe didn't get the amount of attention that you would have hoped?
I think, and I get it. I grew up at the same time, like I was born 81. So the Halcyon video store days, certainly the cable days, the USA Up All Night titles always do well, obviously our Vice Academy series is very popular.
Gone forever, thankfully.
and there are parts of the first Vice Academy I actually really find funny. So I'm not going to say anything bad about Vice Academy. There's things about it I enjoy. Certainly other 80 titles like My Chauffeur, Hobgoblins has its own fan base, whatever. But Joe and I come from a perspective of we spent a lot of time watching 70s exploitation, hard to find titles from our video store days, from 15 years ago. And these are the titles that it's like that deserve that kind of loving and that kind of appraisal, especially at the quality we produce them at. I would say, one of the ones I would point out, two of them we just released, Olivia is phenomenal and a strange movie. I hadn't even heard of it. And as soon as I watched it, I texted Joe. Actually, both of these, I texted Joe right away. Olivia is like, it's like this lost underground low budget De Palma movie. Mm-hmm. And I was reading, did you guys read De Palma's novel yet? Did you read Are Snakes Necessary?
Not yet. I want to.
Okay. It's a weird book. I won't go too far into it, but I was reading it at the same time I saw Olivia, and I was just like, man, like this guy kind of figured out the little, like the De Palma formula, but made it a little sleazier and also a little bit more kind of like cryptic, you know, and the movie works because of it. Like you don't really know how to feel about it, but it has all of those elements of it. And this shift between the first half in London and then it moving to Arizona is just so bizarre. Hmm. You know, it's like a kind of a dreamy, weird, erotic thriller, kind of horror mini slasher. And it just stuck with me. And it's a movie that it's like, I don't know how much play it got. Again, I had never heard of it until obviously Joe discovered it, but it drew me in. Wow. And it's one of those titles where it's like, if you get it at the block, you know, on halfway to Black Friday, you won't be disappointed if you're a big fan of those type of films. It's really going to jump out at you.
I'm shocked an Uli Lamel film didn't sell out straight away, but it's just me.
What was the second one?
And then Deadline.
I was
wrecked by Deadline.
Deadline is bonkers.
I kind of loved it. Elric was kind of lukewarm, but I thought this was quite a gem.
I love that it's bonkers. As a movie, I don't know, but as an experience, it's in the Kathy's Curse world. That's what's, you know, fun about it.
It's a real horror movie to me. Like if you want to see just how low a human being can sink psychologically. And it's just, you're just kind of like watching this and you're just unfolding, you know, and you're just like, God, like this guy has everything. And it's like, and then it's like, but he doesn't have anything. And you're just, your jaw just keeps falling. And it's like, once that twist comes, it's like a total, it knocks you out.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh my God, you know, it just, I don't get surprised very often, but Deadline was a real horror movie for me as terms of like, God, I could see this happening.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good one. I'm curious if there's a focus to part threes in your filmography, because I see Extra Three, beyond the Door Three. Is this a trend or just coincidence?
Total coincidental. Beyond the Door 3 is fantastic, by the way. If you want to see a pure distillation of basically the gore scenes from a bunch of Italian movies with no plot, that's not Cat in the Brain, you can watch Beyond the Door 3, and it's like it's pretty sensational. It also has phenomenal miniature work. Has everyone watched Beyond the Door 3?
No, I haven't seen that one.
No, I haven't seen it yet. I just been making my way through the first one. Yeah. Well, and what about, is there a two?
You don't need to watch any other. Two was the American retitling of Mario Bava's Shock.
Okay.
It has no connection. None of the films have any connection to each other. The original title for Beyond the Door 3 was The Train. The producer, Ovidio Assonides, who also produced The Visitor, decided that because he had made Beyond the Door and the American distributor of Beyond the Door called Bava's Shock Beyond the Door 2, he should call this totally unrelated movie Beyond the Door 3. So that's how we have Beyond the Door 3. Extra 3 came to us because it was it's owned by the same people who own The Ice Cream Man. And they'd been wanting us to license more films for them for a long time, and we finally decided Extra 3 would be all right. And it's done okay. But I just want to throw in another title to highlight from recent releases, Hollywood Horror House.
You know what? I just watched
this. Tell me. So, all right, guys. This is Ryan. I bought my Dolly Dearest, and I'm eagerly awaiting that. Sell me on this film, Joe. Sell me on the movie, because this is what I'm circling. I need to see it.
Well, I mean, I wrote the copy, and the copy is fantastic.
Well, I gotta buy. It's either blind buy. I want to be sold on the blind buy. Come on, give it to me.
Okay, so I think that the best sell for Hollywood Horror House, and I'm going to paraphrase the copy here because it really is fantastic. I'm very proud of it. Is that it's a psychedelic proto slasher by way of Sunset Boulevard.
All right. That's good. I'm listening.
The other sell from my paraphrasing of the copy is that it was produced by a guy who ran a tour bus company, or like a touring bus thing for star homes. So the film is loaded with people who were born before 1920. And it features Joe Besser, the final third stooge, in a cameo as the bus driver of the director producer's tour bus company.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
And it also has a decapitation. Miriam Hopkins has some side boob in it. She was about 70 at the time. I mean, it's a pretty unique film.
Any exploitation, if you love Whatever Happened to Baby Jane or Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte or Who Slew Auntie Rue, Hollywood Horror House fits in really nicely with those.
It looks amazing. I've been circling it since you guys announced this one. So I maybe I'll pull this trigger. Maybe I'll just do this.
It took 3 years to be finished. The shooting finished after Miriam Hopkins was already dead.
One, if you guys like me, do everything through Letterboxd. It's actually not called that on Letterboxd. It's called Savage Intruder. Is that an alternate title that's pretty common?
That was a retitle. It was shot. So the original production title was The Comeback, which again sort of references Sunset Boulevard. Then, and this one I don't understand at all. When they were first in post-production on it, they decided to call it She's Dead and Living in Hollywood. and then they settled on Hollywood Horror House.
Interesting. Wow. Okay. And that one's out now, right? We can get that one? Okay.
That one, I think, was February, Joe, was part of that?
Yeah, I think so.
Yep.
One of the things that's really impressed me that you guys have ramped up on since the last time you guys were on the show is kind of your box set collections. Amityville box set was a great set. No, I mean, it really was a good quality. Yeah, no, it was a good quality set. The movies are much better than most people remember. But it seems like it's also kind of kicked off like a little bit of a trend, you guys dipping into doing more box sets of that caliber. Including the upcoming Forgotten Gialli set. So I don't know, is box sets kind of a new thing? It's out now. Okay, there we go. Well, tell us about that, because these are films that have never been released here, the Forgotten Gialli one.
Yeah, they're all films that never even had English dubs. So they are completely fresh to the U.S. and I think to the English language speaking world. Basically, we've gone on a European licensing rampage recently. And a few months ago, we were thinking, okay, how are we going to best package these? What are we going to do with them? And we kind of came to the conclusion that most of them are too rare for people to have any idea what they are. So why don't we just start doing box sets? So this is going to be a trend that we're hopefully going to continue over the next at least year. We have a few more in the works, both in terms of Giallo specific box sets. We're hoping to have another one out in the fall. No guarantees, because it's all dependent on the labs in Italy and Spain, and therefore the country's reopenings. But fingers crossed, we'll have another one out in the fall. With some slightly better known titles. But we're also doing some other box set concepts. We're going to be doing some collections of Spanish horror films, Giallo specific, but just Spanish horror of the 70s and 80s. And perhaps some box sets that aren't quite entirely grounded in the horror world that are still horror adjacent.
Okay.
How much has the quarantine and everything that's been going on just society-wise been affecting the business model for you guys? Because I know Joe used to work at Odd Obsession, and I was very sad to see their shuttering last night, which was a surprise and a bummer. But how are you guys doing?
Right now we're doing all right. I mean, it's hard to tell what the long-term effects, if any, are going to be. You know, it's too early to like say there's been a noticeable change because orders are still basically as they have been. You know, not being able to go to conventions has certainly hurt, both in terms of the social aspect as well as just, you know, obvious revenue loss from not being able to go to conventions.
A physical store too, right, Joe? Like in Connecticut?
Yeah, the physical store of the Archive has temporarily closed. You know, that when it will reopen is to be determined, hopefully sooner rather than later, but you know, we're gonna hold off until it's basically deemed the right thing to do. But you know, everything else is still in the works as much as it can be. Everyone, you know, films are still being scanned, restored, orders are still going out, so everything is normal to whatever extent it can be normal. Anywhere you're listening, if it's been a month and you still haven't gotten your package, it's not our fault. Sorry. No. I say that sort of sarcastically, but it's really true. Like, we have, once it's out of our hands, there's literally nothing we can do.
Hmm. Do people, when they buy, get a notification like that it's leaving you? So is it clear? Like, yeah, we did our part.
Yeah. They get a tracking number, and sometimes they sit in Bridgeport where they're all shipped from for a week, and then they suddenly show up on your doorstep. Other times they sit in some other random city on their way to somewhere else where they then sit for a long period of time. I mean, there have been instances, and this is even before all of this stuff, like the current horribleness, where people have complained about, you know, their package is, let's say, going to Colorado, and it'll go from Connecticut to New York to Colorado to Florida to Chicago to New York back to Colorado, and they finally get it.
Wow. Okay, so I've got a very important question for you, gentlemen. Should I purchase Beyond Evil, Sight Unseen?
Did you like Mausoleum?
I fucking loved Mausoleum. It was a discovery. Beyond Evil for you. Sold!
Beyond Evil is like the nicer TV movie version, but it's not a TV movie.
And there's Saxon in it.
And there's Saxon.
There is John Saxon in it. That and Hellmaster.
And Linda DeGeorge. I mean, yeah. Jesus.
I want to say that Beyond Evil and Hellmaster, if you're a John Saxon fan, you got to have both of them.
Yeah. How is Hellmaster? It's in my hand right now. I'm actually.
Hellmaster is great. Imagine if John Saxon was like a cool uncle version of Freddy Krueger in Detroit. Well, you know, he's still kind of molesty, but he like might give you $20.
Well, actually, you know.
And he has a trench coat.
Yes.
You know the guy that's kind of like he plays like kind of a cripple in the movie. He's got like the stilts and stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, that's my buddy Sean Sweeney, who I worked with in Amoeba. So he would always tell me, he's like, I did a horror movie once with John Saxon in the 90s, but you'll never find it. So thank you guys for unlocking that skeleton in his closet.
Yeah, there's some great effects in Hellmaster. You know, if you like kind of the goopy, you know, practical stuff, there's some solid effects with Saxon as kind of this dream master Freddy Krueger type character, kind of, you know, harassing these kids. So it's very, like, it's a lot of fun there, you know, and Saxon is great at it. He totally leans into playing, you know, like this kind of sleazy mad scientist demon. You know.
Oh man.
So briefly back on Beyond Evil, two things that I greatly appreciate about Beyond Evil. It has so many opticals of lasers coming out of eyes and zapping things. And it also has a very quick and sadly kind of underutilized shot of a head being chopped open vertically.
Oh, okay.
It's a really quick shot. And I you know, it's impossible to see if you watch any previous version because it's so dark. Yeah. And it's still pretty dark. But it happens at the end of like a fantasy dream sequence. And it's like a machete just like starts to chop into a head vertically and then it just ends.
Nice. All right. Yeah, that was the thing. Until you guys put out Mausoleum, I kind of did not see it. And then I bought it when you announced it. And it wound up being like probably the most joyous evening of my life of the last year. and it was because of these very things that you speak of, which are opticals and lasers and all that kind of shit. So I am I think I'm on board.
Yeah, Beyond Evil, I think, kind of came in a little bit under, people. That month was Pledge Night month, and everyone wanted Pledge Night. So Beyond Evil and Secta Sinestra, kind of like people weren't as familiar with those, so they didn't grab them up as much as Pledge Night and The Vineyard, with James Bond. Yeah. That was also very popular. So those two kind of like led the charge. But Beyond Evil and Secta Sinestra, both very worthwhile titles.
Yeah.
Speaking of formats and stuff, you guys just announced the big one is Rad coming out.
Oh my god.
But it's also the second title behind Tammy and the T-Rex that you're dipping into the kind of the 4K release strategy. Is this have people been responsive to this? I mean, it's been hard enough to get people out of DVD to Blu-ray, hence why we usually have to include both at this point. But what are your thoughts on both Rad and just kind of dipping more into 4K at this point?
If people buy the 4K, then we'll keep doing them, because I've had people ask me like, oh, will you go back and do 4K as some of the older titles, or is it just going to be newer stuff? And the response is always like, look, if you buy it, we'll follow the trend. If the 4K sells out, we'll put out more in 4K. That's the way, all business works. If the 4K doesn't sell as well, then we're less likely to do more than a few at a time. But, I remember I told Joe about 4K several years ago, and he was kind of like on the fence about it, and then he warmed to it eventually. I'll go back a sec. So, yes, we'll scream Rad from the rooftops, but I also want to promote. We're putting out Patty Hearst. We're putting out Schrader. Vinegar Syndrome is releasing a Paul Schrader film, Right, yeah. And that kind of got buried a little bit, and Patty Hearst is not – it kind of gets lumped together with that mid-80s Schrader post-Mishima. So it kind of fits in there with like, oh, it's like, The Light of Day and Comfort of Strangers. But it's better than that. And it's certainly better than, mid-2000s Schrader output. I'm sure that there's one guy that loves the Canyons, but he's dead because people with taste murdered him, So the Patty Hearst is a really solid, interesting movie that's kind of a little of a biopic, but also a lot of Schrader commenting on modern society, and like both wealth and capitalism and media. And it's definitely worthwhile because I think it got like a MGM MOD release where they just kind of dumped it from like, and it may have just been off of a print or something. I don't think it was necessarily that great of a transfer, but this is for me, the title of Halfway to Black Friday Sale is Patty Hearst. If you're a Schrader fan at all, you should be super excited to have this. And if you're not, this is a great chance to discover one of the best directors' kind of underseen movies.
Yeah, this is a movie not just for William Forsythe, the completists. I think it's important that you realize that. Put down your Dick Tracy and pick up your Patty Hearst. That's what I said.
It's a good sell. Is there anything you could tease us about in the future? Like, I don't even know how far in advance you guys are in terms of like, obviously you have things coming out every month, but do you have most of 2020 slotted out release wise, or is that always kind of ever evolving? Oh, wow.
Oh. I'm going to look up the cover for first to see if it's one that rings a bell. From which year? 87? That period? So Arthur Seidelman. I don't think so. Cover. It doesn't ring a bell. Malcolm McDowell film.
The cover rings a bell, but I've never seen this film. Malcolm McDowell.
It's one of the Empire Pictures movies from the twilight of Empire Pictures.
Interesting.
But it feels a bit more like a theatrical piece. It's mm-hmm. dreamy and weird, and it's basically a two character study of these two people who claim to be who they claim to be, maybe aren't who they claim to be, have ulterior motives on each other. Right. And it's not a horror movie in the conventional sense, but it definitely begins to drift into more supernatural horror territory as it goes along.
Becca's texting saying she has seen.
Well, that's cool. I've never even heard of this one. This is that'll be a cool one to check out. Jeff, did you see this? Because I know that the title announcement was going to be a surprise to you as well.
Yes. I mean, I am always surprised when Joe kind of like reveals something to me or to the public. I'm always like, wait, what is this? It's very rare that but from his description of it, I'm like, oh, it's like a Harold Pinter play that becomes a Vinegar Syndrome movie. This is great. This is perfect for us. And you know, like, we have a couple of months where we sneak in some real avant-garde kind of experimental works. And sometimes they work for people and sometimes they don't. I know some people love Liquid Skies, some don't. I get it. We had that month last year where we did Putney Swope, you know, and Taking Tiger Mountain, and The Passing, and one of my ones that both Joe and I really called Night Owl, which is kind of like an early 90s black and white experimental vampire movie. And if you like The Addiction and Nausea, you know, and that whole kind of scene of those kind of early 90s black and white vampire movies, Night Owl fits really well there. And it's like the first John Leguizamo movie. And he's really good at it. You know, and so we sneak, you know, we put your vegetables in there. Like, we douse them in cheese, obviously. But, like, they're in there for you to kind of discover. And, like, and people, and for as much as people come up to me and scream Mausoleum at me at the top of their lungs, I am a guy who kind of comes along and goes, hey, you know what? I really like The Passing. Or I really like Night Owl. And I appreciate that, too. Especially, like, you know, the Putney Swope people, especially for the people who haven't seen Putney Swope, they come up and they're like, I really like this Putney Swope movie. And it's a big win for us.
Yeah.
You know, it's the one title we share with Criterion.
Yeah, I thought that was a great, great release from you guys, by the way.
Yeah, I was at a Barnes & Noble during a Criterion sale, and this guy was telling me, he goes, oh, you know, I wish somebody would put out Putney Swope. I wish Criterion put out Putney Swope on Blu-ray. And I was like, actually, sir, I can help you with that. There's a little company called Vinegar Syndrome, and it's amazing, and we put it out on Blu-ray. And he was just like, what? And I made a friend for life, a 55-year-old ex-music sound engineer turned real estate agent who now is just like, you saved my life. I don't know if he's ever bought anything else, but I know he bought Putney Swope.
I did want to note that something that has been a really pleasantly unexpected aspect of releasing Rad is we've gotten a ton of first-time customers. So the Rad edition is literally only able to be gotten on our site. You can't get it on Amazon. You can't get it off of any other retailer. The only way you're going to get Rad is by going on our site and getting it directly from us. And a lot of the people who have gotten Rad are people who have never ordered anything else from us. So hopefully Rad will introduce them to all sorts of other things and keep them coming back, and who knows. So that's been a really nice unintended effect. And I will give one more tease. I won't announce this title because I don't know when it's actually coming out, but it is coming out this year. The 3D film that we hinted at, the 3D Blu-ray that we hinted at from last year, is now currently scheduled for this year. So this is one that I think will make a lot of people very happy. And it will be our first 3D release, and it will also be a fairly sought after in a specific world title.
We say this every time, and I'll go back to, and especially with Rad, get the subscription package. We have this so you can make sure you're able to get everything you want on the subscription package, because with Rad, the pre-sale is over. So if you're not on there May 22nd, getting your copy like right away, you might be SOL on this, because there's only so many of them, both on Blu-ray and on 4K. Oh, but if you get that subscription package, and every month you're going to get your 4, 5, 6, even 7 discs when we do the box sets, and you're guaranteed your slips, you're guaranteed all the limited edition, all the bells and whistles, and our undying affection. Whereas if you're just buying the disc, you know, like, we love you, but we love you a little bit more if you get the subscription package.
Yeah.
Actually, just to correct that, Rad is still current. We've kept the Rad pre-order up because when we put up the initial weekend, we realized that it was getting a lot of new people to the site. So we decided, why not leave it up and see how it does? And it's continued to sell insanely well. So yeah, there's I'd say at this point, greater than 50% chance that it will not last through the halfway sale based on how it's gone thus far.
Right. And our fan base does not wake up early. So I don't know. Like, if you're logging on at 11 o'clock, we can't promise you anything.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed that Gleaming the Cube isn't too far behind if Rad is a success somewhere in this world. all right, guys. Well, you know, always a pleasure to have you guys on the show. Is there anything else that we should address going forward into the year? I mean, obviously, it's going to be tough to get back to conventions, but people can purchase your stuff direct. And I mean, we're looking forward to more announcements. When can we expect to hear a little bit more of the 2020 slate?
During the sale, we're going to be announcing and putting up for pre-order all of June, as well as possibly announcing most or all of July, and maybe another October title. October is, September through November are 100% horror.
Nice.
So, and hopefully we'll have another Giallo box set, if all goes well, coming in September.
That's the best thing we can say, is we'll keep doing the box sets and the 4Ks if everyone keeps buying them. So if you're, and let us know, you know, we've got the Facebook, you know, pages, you know, on the message boards. Give us the feedback. If you're loving the box sets, let us know so that we can actually continue them. That's a big help for us. That and your money are the loudest speaking, is you saying that you want them and you buying them.
Excellent. All right, guys. Thanks as always for joining us. I know it's weird being, you know, doing this from home as opposed to in person, but we always appreciate it. I'm sure we will have you on again soon enough.
Yes. Thank you guys so much for having us on. We hope to see you all at conventions in the future. But until then, you know, just always feel free to message us on Facebook, on the forums, on our website. We really appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Fangoria and Blumhouse present Shockwaves. Shockwaves is a member of the Fangoria Podcast Network, hosted and produced by Rob Galuzzo, Elric Kane, Ryan Terrick, and Rebecca McKendry. Sound recording, mixing, and editing by Ernie Hurtado. Music by Gregory S. Burkhart. Logo art and design by Aaron Crawford. For Fangoria, Dallas Danier, Phil Nobile Jr., Jessica Safa-Vamare, Brandon Wynardi, Natasha Bassetta, and Rob Galuzzo.